ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
It's one of Australia's most baffling unsolved missing persons cases. In 2007, three adults and a five-year-old girl vanished from Western Australia amid rumours of bizarre behaviour, cults and dark secrets.
Yep, because we're trying to track them down.
I'm Dominique Baines, and I've been investigating for the new season of Expanse, The Nan Up 4.
I was starting to think this is not going to end well.
Subscribe to Expanse wherever you get your podcasts.
It is a beautiful Sunday afternoon, and you are standing in a very big, very open space. It's a public square. And people, they're singing, they're dancing, and they're playing music. And it's a special scene. Not only because of how lively it is, but because it's so rare. You see, normally, you are not allowed to do what you want, when you want. Because you, and all of your friends here, you're all slaves. It's the 1700s, and this is the only place in America where enslaved Africans can gather and dance.
Congo Square was a grassy plain on the outskirts of the French Quarter, the oldest part of New Orleans. After the market activities wound down, people would dance in the form of a ring shout.
In a ring shout, dancers form a circle, musicians are playing handmade instruments, and the people, they're singing.
In a style that's called call and response, where you might have a leader initiating a call and everybody chanting a response over and over. And those kinds of repetitive rhythms, those trance-like chants, created the basis for people to dance in the outside of the ring and for soloists to step in to the center of the ring.
And it was here, believe it or not, that a movement was born. These gatherings would become the heartbeat of a brand new sound. This is the beginnings of jazz.
Congo Square is ground zero for American music, really, but certainly black music in America. Yes, jazz is black music. You cannot have jazz without the African approaches to music making that rooted in Congo Square in the 1700s.
I'm Mark Fennell, and to lots of people, jazz is just the thing they play in coffee chains and hotel lobbies. But actually, the story behind it is an epic of a people, a city, and heroes from the most unexpected places. And no one saw it coming.
I came to New Orleans in the 90s, and I remember somebody telling me, oh yeah, jazz was invented here because when the northern militaries left, you know, they had occupied the city during the Civil War, and when they left their instruments and went back north, and every pawn shop you went to, you could find a bugle or a bass drum, and that's how black musicians acquire these instruments, and they created jazz music with it. And I thought, oh, okay, that's cool.
Yep, it is a cool story. One that has been linked to the birth of jazz for, decades. This idea that it was born from leftover instruments after the US Civil War. However, it turns out that's not the entire story.
I really don't hear that story anymore because it's been so debunked over time. I rarely come across that idea anymore, and I've really studied the history and learned that, yes, sure, there were military instruments that got left behind after the Civil War, and that plays a part in the dissemination of these jazz-type instruments or what became jazz instruments. But the story is much deeper, it's frankly longer, but it's more complicated too, and it's just much more interesting.
So this is Matt Sacchini.
I'm a professor of music here in New Orleans at Tulane University and chair of the music department.
Okay, so if the Civil War marching band instrument story is, let's say, a little bit mythologized, where does the story of jazz really start?
The much deeper and the longer story is that New Orleans already had, in this post-Civil War period, already had an unbroken history of Black musical expression, going back to 718 when the Europeans first brought enslaved peoples to New Orleans. And it wasn't until the limited freedoms of the Civil War that mass numbers of African Americans in New Orleans had access to these modern instruments, sure. But the music itself and the ways of making music go back hundreds of years and probably even millennia before the birth of jazz.
And this is what takes us back to that Congo Square where we started this episode. Now, for some context, in the 1700s, Louisiana was controlled by France. They founded New Orleans in 1718. But then around 40 years later, they ceded Louisiana to the Spanish following the Seven Years' War. But compared to the rest of America, which was mostly under British rule, the French and the Spanish, well, they governed a little differently.
They essentially allowed a limited, unsupervised, I won't say freedoms, but days off for their slaves on Sundays. And in that grassy plain, Congo Square, outside of the French Quarter, enslaved people would gather. It was a market, basically, and there were Native American people there from the Homa and Chitimacha tribes as well. And enslaved people would sell their wares in hopes of buying their own freedom. So many people saved up enough money to purchase what's called manumission, to purchase their own lives back. And New Orleans had the highest number of freed slaves in the whole country. But after the market activities wound down, people would dance in the form of a ring shout.
And for people traveling through Louisiana, like maybe from places like Mississippi across the border, seeing slaves be free to dance and sing, for them that was very strange.
You have these accounts of slave owners maybe taking a wagon in from Mississippi and arriving in New Orleans and showing up at the Congo Square and seeing black slaves, unsupervised, dancing in a ring together. And these shocked accounts of people saying, how can the city leaders let this happen? Because over the border in Mississippi, you would have a plantation life, very rural, where enslaved people did not have those times off, and where drumming and singing often signaled an insurrection to the slave master. So yes, New Orleans was really unique in that way, both as a city, a very cosmopolitan city, unlike the sort of stereotype of the slave plantation as a farm out in the middle of nowhere. And New Orleans was different because the French and the Spanish governed their slaves differently. I don't want to give this sense that it was like easier here. This was very brutal conditions for the enslaved. Many people died. Families were torn apart. It's just a sort of different, and this sounds crude, but a different kind of tactic. The tactic of the Catholics was, if you give slaves Sunday off, they'll work harder 6 days a week. So that was very unique within the United States.
So why is this particular moment so important, I guess, in that broader journey towards jazz as we recognize it now?
That's the key question, because if these ring shouts had just happened and then they went away, who knows how New Orleans music would have developed. But what happened in the city is that sort of African bass layer was nurtured and it grew over time. Now, mind you, as we get into the 1840s and 50s, the city leaders are putting a stop to these dances. We're on the march towards the Civil War. The freedoms for enslaved peoples were never more limited than in that time. And yet, the practices, the call and response, the repetitive rhythms, the polyrhythms, the improvisation, they were already in place and they had already been allowed to kind of grow. And so what happens during the Civil War is you have the city under occupation, and then afterward you have the sort of limited freedoms that come with emancipation. No one is saying that American society then transforms into this space of utopian equality, but you do have black people who can purchase their own homes or their businesses, and importantly for our story, their own instruments. So those dances that started, you know, 150 years earlier are important because they nurtured the musical approaches, the literal musical techniques that would change with the limited freedoms that came after the Civil War and in the lead up to jazz.
Okay, so there is this musical language that's been growing over the years, a sort of rhythm, call and response, improvisation. All of that you can kind of trace back to the times when the French and Spanish were in charge of New Orleans. With emancipation, when the slaves are supposed to be freed throughout America, you see African Americans buying more things like musical instruments. But this is really a story about the place, so New Orleans, because it was, and frankly still is, a huge melting pot of cultures.
What we find in New Orleans is really a bustling world mecca of a port city and just an incredibly cosmopolitan place. New Orleans was the largest city by far in the southern United States. In the late 1800s, it was a world leader in terms of global trade and labor and the port and shipping industry. And New Orleans was a site where waves of immigrants would come into the city, Irish and Germans before the Civil War, and then Italians, Jews, Chinese after the Civil War, and much later on, waves of Vietnamese immigrants fleeing the Vietnam War. This was a time when Italians and Jewish Americans were not seen as white by the dominant class of white leaders in our country. And so when jazz was sort of incubating in New Orleans in this period right after the Civil War, you have Black Americans interacting with Jews, Italians, and other immigrants at a class level, at the lower strata of society, when American sort of racial categories haven't really been settled yet. They're in flux.
So regardless of creed and class, there is this collaboration that is bubbling up. And really what's bridging the divide between all of these different cultures is music.
And what's happening in every single one of those communities is music. And what's happening in every single one of those communities is marching bands. I'm talking about, you've got Portuguese churches with the brass band. You've got Italian, of course, churches with the brass band, and Irish as well. And for the first time in great numbers, you have Black New Orleanians now with access to these instruments to form their own brass bands. And it's through this parade culture out in the streets with these instruments that would become the instruments in jazz music. That's where you see the seeds of both interaction across these lines and the seeds of music that we would later recognize as jazz.
Okay, so we're at the turn of the 20th century now, and a key character in the story of jazz enters. This is a young man by the name of Buddy Bolden.
Charles Joseph Buddy Bolden. He's known as the first man of jazz, and he really fits the profile. Very working class Black musician, growing up in the Uptown district where his parents take him to the Black Baptist Church as a kid. His dad worked in cotton and would unload or load bales of cotton onto ships in the canals of New Orleans, and those dock workers would sing songs that we would recognize today as blues music or work songs, you know, these solo laments and songs that accompany labor. There was a barber shop on his neighborhood where he hung out as a child and heard musicians, you know, waiting for gigs and practicing. These street parades where Black brass bands would accompany the dancing of benevolent societies and burial societies would come by his house, and he would hear, you know, the horns and the drums.
And it's believed that Bolden, he kind of merged these influences in his music.
He took the blues hollers, and he took the ecstatic sounds of the Black church, and he took the dance rhythms that were popular at the time and that go back to Congo Square and others, and kind of assimilated into this music that musicians at the time called ratty. It was just improvised and low down. It was music for night people. It was music that got rattier at clubs and dance halls and society balls as the night would go on.
Okay, so I would love to play you some of Bolden's music, but I can't. And it's not because of, music rights or lawyers. No, it's because it doesn't exist in any recorded fashion.
There's no recording of Bolden, but we don't actually know what Bolden's music sounded like. There's this lore that maybe there's a cylinder that was in someone's attic and these jazz historians went looking for it, but they could never find it. So we really have to piece together scraps of memory and myth to try to figure out the role that Buddy Bolden played in the emergence of jazz. What was unique about this music? So even if we don't actually know what Bolden sounded like, he takes on mythical status because he does have that background in the church. And he brings in a whole approach to music making that's rooted in improvisation. The way you become a leader in jazz or black music is to be able to, in performance, come up with something on the spot. Where the way you become a leader in European art music is to write that music down on paper and have people play it faithfully. So Bolden brought together improvisation, he brought together blues, he brought together call and response, he brought together these repetitive trance-like rhythms, he brought together the ecstatic fever pitch feeling out of the church and put it on the bandstand.
So Bolden brings the elements together, but the explosion, though, is with somebody else. This is a name that I think more people will be familiar with, which is Louis Armstrong. Where does he enter the story?
He saw himself as a larger-than-life epic musician, but he came from the humblest of circumstances, born in a black prostitution district known as the Tenderloin in a Bacatown neighborhood in New Orleans. He was surrounded by music. He claimed to have heard Buddy Bolden at the theater near his house. Definitely he heard marching band, New Orleans brass band music with his father leading the parade coming through his neighborhood. He heard blues music on the docks and in the bars. He grew up in an environment that's so overwhelmingly musical, it's impossible to imagine today. But he also developed his talent. And that began first when he sang quartet music on the streets, what we now call a barbershop quartet music. He would gather together with a few friends and they would harmonize together.
Then, on New Year's Eve, 1913, Armstrong's life changed forever. At the stroke of midnight, he grabbed a gun out of the pocket of another singer and he fired it into the air. It wasn't meant to be violent. Yeah, it was like a celebration, like a loud crack to ring in the new year. But a policeman was there. And young Lewis ended up in the Colored Waif's home in New Orleans.
This was essentially a juvenile detention center for black children in New Orleans.
And it's probably true to say that if little Louis hadn't been arrested during the New Year's Eve festivities of 1913 in New Orleans and sent to the Waif's home, charged with firing firearms within the city limits, jazz might have taken a very different course.
And he spent something on the order of a year and a half in that center.
They say when I was in the bugler of the institution, that little orphanage, I used to blow the bugle for the boys to drill by and things like that. And they had a little brass band, and finally the cornet player went home and they put me in there. And I used to enjoy playing Saints Go Marching In for the kids that march to church on Sundays. And quite naturally, even before I went in there, I was singing a little quartet, always around the music.
And eventually, very quickly, made him leader of the Colored Waif's Home Brass Band. Essentially, Louis Armstrong was a prodigy on the trumpet, on this cutting-edge instrument from the early 1900s. And after he got out of the waif's home, he started playing in nightclubs, and he worked his way up through the great brass bands of the city.
Why is it that Louis Armstrong is considered so important in the pathway to modern jazz? Like, why does he matter so much?
He created improvised trumpet solos that sounded like masterworks. In other words, he could pick up the trumpet and let the notes flow out of him openly. But what came out of him was not just a series of notes. They were like little stories, little coherent musical phrases that captured the imagination of listeners. And so Armstrong, like Bolden, brought together a bunch of different influences. But unlike Bolden, some of those influences were way outside of the black vernacular culture of New Orleans. Armstrong loved to listen to opera. Armstrong would sit with his trumpet and try to play along to these opera melodies, and he could assimilate that. And so Armstrong, in some ways, was a more curious musician, a more open musician, and really that's what allowed him to create this incredibly unique and revolutionary music that unlike anything anyone had heard before.
And then one day in 1928, in Chicago, a 26-year-old Louis Armstrong walks into a recording studio. It's cramped, it's warm, and has not much by way of equipment. But Louis and his band, they have everything they need. And when they start playing, little do they realize they're about to make music history.
It's like a 3-minute masterpiece, but hardly any of this was written down. It was just completely made up on the spot. So I think to me, that's a moment that no one saw coming. West End Blues in 1928, and the kind of alchemy, the kind of magic that comes together when musicians are being creative together.
And what they're playing in this recording studio will be able to be heard across the United States and frankly across the world, which at the time was totally revolutionary.
This is the first time in the history of the world that you can listen to music without a live musician sitting face to face in front of you. What does that mean for jazz? Well, jazz is becoming the America's popular music at the same time as the invention of these sound technologies. And so you have people in the U.S. and all around the world that can listen to the ingenuity of these black New Orleans musicians, but be in the safety of their New York apartment or in their Parisian flat or founding a record club in Tokyo. The impact, the sort of ripple effect, like Armstrong's record drops in the water and these concentric circles of rippling effects happen because that sound that he made that was so unique was able to travel places even he couldn't go.
It has to be said that there are so many tendrils in the history of jazz and so many more epic stories that can and should be told. But for now, I just want you to do this. When you hear jazz, maybe when you're in a cafe or you're on hold, maybe you're in a dark dive bar and it's being played out loud, whatever, I want you to listen beyond the notes to the story behind it. Because etched into the ridges of those records are the dance moves of exhausted, enslaved people, the religious fervour of hollered church songs. I want you to feel the stride of the marching bands down the street. Because it is all there between the notes, if you know what you're listening for.
It's complex to tell the story of a seemingly simple music. I mean, we drop a needle on a record from 1927 and we hear that scratchy sound and it sounds old and antiquated. It's hard for us to realize just how much sort of revolutionary creativity and how much history based in this place and based in the race of Black Americans get condensed in a jazz recording like West End Blues.
That was Matt Sacchicchini, professor of music and the chair of the music department at Tulane University in New Orleans. This episode was produced by Zoe Ferguson and Ellie Parnell. The sound engineer was Kerry Dell. Thank you so much for listening. As always, if you have got a story or something you'd like us to investigate, you know the deal. Just email us. noonesawitcoming@abc.net.au. We would love to hear from you, even if you've got like half an idea. We'll look into it. Leave it with us. I'm Mark Fennell. I'll be back with a brand new episode next week of No One Saw It Coming. Until then, bye.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.